This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, or meeting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Just one moment. Over to you, Ajahn, and thank you very much for
the beautiful rendition. No worries. No worries at all, Chris. So, with meditation, what is the experience? The experience, the ways, the why, the wherefore of the meditation practice.
I'm sorry.
No?
I'm very sorry, Ajahn.
Yeah.
If you touch that at all, we get scratchy sound.
Oh, okay. I'll keep it away from the body. No worries, Chris. No worries.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, nice to your sharp mindfulness is nice to see. Okay. So
I'm
with the
sharp.
No, you're doing okay. Doesn't matter how old you are, you're still sharp. Yep. Okay. So So with the meditation experience, you know, so I mean, what do we actually see when we start the meditation, you know, say from beginners to especially for at the beginner stage, can be quite a new experience for some people. You know, you get different kinds of moods and feelings and different kinds of mind states, but over time people definitely see an increase in say tolerance and peace, kindness and compassion, because you know meditation practice is very simplistic, but it's quite refined. You know, as you practice over the months and years, you know, you start to see good qualities arise within oneself that you didn't necessarily notice so much previously. And so, you know, you see in essence that as one develops the meditation practice and one refines the mind, then you see, you know, it's like the moon coming out from behind the clouds, you know, that you get the good qualities start to come to the forefront, and things like irritation, jealousy, anger, all these sort of garden variety experiences, say unpleasant emotions that we have, different views and opinions and attitudes, they start to say like recede. They start to recede and diminish and become less of a force in the mind. So it depends on the individual concern, because every single one of us, we all have our personal karma, our personal makeup, and you're looking at lifetimes of past karma, different states of mind that have been with you for a lifetime. So you can't necessarily shake certain moods and certain attitudes off within weeks or even months. It's even for abbots, it's still possible for abbots after 30, 40 years to still experience anger, irritation, annoyance. You're looking at lifetimes of karma, so you've got this massive storehouse of emotions, both pleasant and unpleasant, behind you that you're working through. Because with the meditation practice, you're going into your personality, so you're going to see everything that makes you up, all the nice stuff, all the not so nice aspects of one's personality. But the thing is that this inward journey that you are undertaking, it's all within the framework of the Buddhist teaching, and it's connecting with the Four Noble Truths, where you're seeing the nature of the mind in its entirety. So the vast majority would like nice, loving, fluffy, warm feelings. The vast majority of the time, even the monks and nuns would prefer it. But you're going to run the full gauntlet of different emotions. But one thing you can be guaranteed of is a refinement of the mind, over time. And so, as the weeks, especially, more like, say, the months pass by, your family members and partners and close friends will easily see the good qualities that you are actually bringing to the surface in the mind. So all of us have these very, very, wholesome qualities at the deeper levels in the mind. But it's the dross, it's the dust in the mind which obscures the goodness, the joy, these very, very what would you call, say, like altruistic, warm, deep, loving, refined emotions, the kind of refined emotions that you would expect, you expect from the monks and nuns, at least in a small degree, because we're supposed to be doing this full time, but depending on time and location, how much time you have to practice. So the kind of things that you expect from the monastics, you expect from long-term practitioners, 20, 30 years, and even in general society, Buddhist people have a fairly good reputation, and even the average person on the street would expect a Buddhist person to have a minimum level of kindness, compassion, tolerance, and patience. Low levels of say anger, intolerance, revenge, this kind of stuff. So Buddhists tend to have a good reputation in general society. So that key point in a nutshell is a refinement of the mind, and then allowing the good qualities to shine forth and to dominate and become a prominent, become like an enduring force in the mind as the years go by. So as we see the Buddhist teaching, that many of you guys who've been probably right through the Pali Canon or at least know a handful of key suttas, that the whole with the Buddhist teaching, it circles around the actual development of the mind, the refinement. Development of wholesome states, development of peace, wisdom, understanding the nature of human beings, the nature of life. And so, you know, this is the journey that we're on. And for many of us, you know, it can take several lifetimes of work in order to break through. But once you reach that point, you know, once you've got that, you know, quite deep samadhi and the vipassana, the wisdom, insight, understanding at the same level, then you've got the potential to break through. If you move in the right direction, I tend to do a lot. I'm doing a lot of meditation practice connected with the Anicca principle, and you know, as long as I don't do more than say five hours a day, I'm in a reasonable, sort of comfortable range. But it's got a lot of benefits to it, and for me, it's working very, very well at the moment. And the Buddha made that very, very clear in the sutras that, you know, he said it's specifically with the monastics. This is the work for the monastics, the Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta. So with all of us, that, you know, it's all very nice to get peaceful, calm, and to be tolerant and understanding and whatnot. But you've got to have your wisdom, you know, no matter what your personal makeup, you know, your wisdom, the wisdom component you've got to maintain that at the same level as your samadhi, your peacefulness of mind. You never allow that to slip behind, because this is the key principle within the Buddha's teaching. So, you know, no matter how peaceful you're getting, I mean, some of you may get very, very good states of samadhi on even at home in good good circumstances on personal retreat. But the bottom line is you've got to keep the wisdom at the same level. No matter what your faculties, the wisdom has got to be the key principle. It's got to be the dominant principle, no matter how highly you're developed, how long you've been practicing, or if you're just a raw beginner, because that's what makes a difference in the long term. That's what watches over and balances the full faculties of the mind, of one's human experience. Because, you know, in just briefly, you know, this whole disaster, this, you know, humanitarian disaster with Russia and Ukraine, I mean, Putin was a very, 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 very smart, capable, cunning, individual. But you see the limits of cunning and intelligence. You see the listen. You know, Putin's not a wise man by any degree, and he demonstrated that very, very clearly. So there's a different, you know, with all of us, you know, wisdom. You see wisdom in action, and that's exactly what we are aiming for with this practice. So, no matter what you do, whatever kind of meditation, the kind of personal qualities you have, wisdom has to watch over and keep one's faculties, one's mind in balance. You know, like in harmony to a degree within yourself internally, with yourself and other people, and with work and one's extended circle of family and friends. It's like according with the Tao, being in balance with nature, both internally and externally. So with the meditation, we'll do, I'm a little bit of a fan with that dark color meditation, but I don't want to maybe harp on about it too much. So we'll do something different. We'll do the moving meditation, which was one of Ayakama's, so with the Venerable Ayakama, who passed away a number of years ago, one of her, a very long-term retreat teacher, very successful Buddhist teacher. And one of the techniques that she used was to focus on the moving breath. So as the, you know, this is like an Anicca principle, you know, because naturally our thoughts and feelings change quite quickly, but the moving breath is something which is a little bit deeper, because you're looking like internally. The breath in itself is a vital principle. Without breath, you're gone, you're finished. So, you know, we're focusing on the breath, a vital principle. watching the changing feelings and sensations of the breath, you know, coming in through the nose, and then moving down the upper middle chest, down through the abdomen, and then back out again. So as the breath moves in and out of the physical body, we're actually watching all the feelings from top to bottom as the breath comes in, right down middle of the chest, and then to the tummy, and then back out again, you know, tummy, you know, abdomen, middle of the chest, and out through the nose. So the full breath cycle, watching all those feelings, you know, in and out of the physical body. And that tends to, one of the characteristics of that, it increases your perception of the changeability of phenomena, which is something all of us have to do in daily life. So the more you do this kind of thing, the better you get, the sharper you get. Because no matter how smart or how a simple person you are, that when you focus on that anicca sanya, the perception of changeability internally, externally, that it's going to make your faculties sharper, because you're focusing on change, you know, to a degree, you know, the time that you have with the meditation, the time that you spend on it, as you move through the course of your day, and it makes you makes the faculties more sharp, more aware, you know, you notice things much more. The average person walking the street, you're running the full range of people in general society, but with this kind of practice, it makes you much more aware as things change on a second to second, you know, through the senses, the ear, eye, nose, tongue, body, you know, as things change, you become more aware of phenomena, and you pick up and you notice things as they change from say second to second, minute to minute. Okay, so we'll start with the meditation practice. Just get yourself in a comfortable position with your hands together in your lap. You know, you can sit as you choose. You can sit as you choose, either with the ankles crossed, or, you know, just with the feet, the toes, just comfortably on the floor. It's good to have the hands together, because it tends to draw the energy of the mind inwards. Some people can definitely feel the difference when they cross their ankles and they put their hands together or touch their fingers together in the Zazen, the Zen meditation posture. They can actually feel a more moving inwards, a more gathering together of the energies of the body, the energies of the mind. So we'll spend that. Let's have a look at what. Okay, we'll do this so you can get a real sense for this. Maybe we'll do it for 15 minutes, and then we'll lock at one point. We'll lock at around the feelings around the mouth. So we'll do the moving meditation so you can get a sense for it, and then we'll do 15 minutes, like locked at one point, the feelings around the mouth section. And so make sure your back is straight. Try to keep your head upright, your chin upright if possible. Make sure you can breathe into the full chest and there's nothing tight around the throat, the waist, the wrists, and breathe fully into the abdomen. And focus on those feelings. So as you're breathing in through the nose or the mouth, focus on those feelings as the breath moves. You know, you can focus on the mouth, and then the middle of the chest, and then the abdomen, breathing out, middle of the chest, you know, the nose or the mouth. So, you know, initially the three points: the nose, middle of the chest, the abdomen, and then, you know, breathing in and out, until you can just do it naturally. You can just follow it all the way in, just gradually all the way in, all the way out. And do that for the next 15 minutes. So as you follow the moving sensations of the breath, just try to slow the breathing down as much as possible, because it gives you more sharpness, more accuracy as you track the sensations.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll move to the second half of the meditation. So what I want you to do now is focus on one point. So we'll focus on the feelings around the mouth, which is very, very sharp, very distinct, and you can follow that very, very easy. And we'll use the changeability principle, this perception of changeability. So as you're breathing out, say an easy one, flowers, breathing in, breathing out, changeable. Breathing in, breathing out, flowers, breathing in, breathing out, changeable. So we'll focus on that one point, focus on the feelings around the mouth. You'll feel the breath at that point. And as you're breathing out, you say the mantra with the space between the words. And we'll do that for the rest of the session. Okay, so we're coming towards the end of the session. So just take a look at the mind state and see if there's any change whatsoever. Sometimes different objects, different meditation objects will give you sometimes better results. If you go like internally, maybe thoughts, feelings, things inside the mind sometimes can work better than external things like flowers, trees and whatnot. So I'll ring the bell 3 times. You can open your eyes when you're ready.
That was really very, very blissful and very peaceful.
Gee, it sounds like your meditation is pretty good, Chris.
Thank you. Yes, it was. Thank you. Would you like to continue with your talk?
You choose to talk. You choose the talk or subject, and we'll take it from there.
Anxiety,
okay. So that feeling of anxiety,
cycle that you get into, and in the same way that you get into an anger cycle.
Right.
And what I get into, and then it becomes difficult to break out of it. The confusion and the other emotions come into play. And I'm wondering whether you have any tricks about breaking out of that cycle.
For example, if we get certain strong feelings, you know, especially most of us can handle pleasant feelings, and the more the better, the more the merrier type of thing. But with unpleasant emotions, moods, attitudes, different views and opinions. We can feel it impinging on the mind. It's an uncomfortable state. It could be moderately painful or even worse than that. But the thing is that we may not be able to, even though on a conceptual level we know for a fact, especially we've been following Buddhist practice or actually practicing the Buddhist principles for quite some time. We're quite aware that we need to sort of let this thing go, this experience, this mood, the attachment to relinquish, to release the attachment to that mind experience. But one of the key things is that you've really got to understand what you're going through. So when This is mentioned to me years ago, and it still cuts the ice, where that when we get caught, we get caught in certain moods, certain mind states. You've really got to understand exactly what's happening there, because the reason why anger, anxiety, resentment, could be jealousy, why these moods keep persisting over time. And the main reason is because we really do not understand to a reasonable degree or depth exactly what's happening. So if I have a problem, the monks go through this kind of stuff all the time, every day. And if you can't let this thing go, this mood, this attitude, you get obsessed with a person, there was some kind of difficulty, some kind of friction, and this person's, they're on your mind, you can't release it, and it could be haunting you, and you think to yourself, this is unpainful, it's quite a painful experience, but why can't I abandon this? Why can't I free myself from this thing, this mood, this emotion? And the key principle is that you still have not understood to a significant degree exactly what's happening to you, because every single one of us know, if you knew for a fact that you could just with sheer willpower, it's more like releasing. It's letting go. It's releasing. It's not force. It's relinquishing. It's like opening. You know, like you've got something. You know, you're holding a tennis ball in one's hand, and then you just open your fingers and drop it. It's like that. You know, it's just there's not much force. It's releasing, letting go. So, with all of us, if you can't do that, it's quite clear that we don't understand exactly what we're going through and why and where and with what person at what time. It's like this thing is under a rock, and it's hidden from you. You can't see exactly what's happening in its entirety. If you really understood this unpleasant experience, you could just drop it instantly within 5 to 10 seconds. You could drop it within seconds as soon as it comes up. And that will be a test of your vipassana, your insight knowledge, how your ability to relinquish and to free yourself from this stuff. So it's very, very easy for me to, you know, it's very easy for me to say these things, but the test is, when you come in contact with that difficult person, or you're under pressure, or your workload is up to your eyeballs, and there's all sorts of stuff going on, and you get affected by these particular moods or beliefs or ideas, or it could be obsessions with different people, if you can't let this stuff go, it's quite clear. It's quite clear to you, to me, to everyone, that you still haven't understood. The investigation, the understanding still hasn't gone deep enough, because that's the test. If you can drop it instantly or within a very short time frame, it means that you really understand what's happening there. It could be 101 different experiences. All of us are very different with different karma. Karma is incredibly complicated, so no matter what anyone, it's like one of our disciples when she lost her daughter. The other long term disciples, told her multiple times, just let it go, let it go, let the feelings go. You know, it's all very easy to say this stuff, but it took her a couple of years before she was able to do that. So, but the bottom line is, for all of us, you've got to understand. You've got one of the easiest ways to deal with this experience is to do your meditation, whichever way is suitable for you, and then you bring this thing up, this experience up after about 5 minutes, 10 minutes, when you've got some real focus or samadhi, and then you start to contemplate it, and you've got to go into it. You've got to understand everything. Everything about it. It doesn't matter how trivial. You could have looked at it 10 times, 20 times, 30 times. It's still not enough, because you can't drop it. You know, this is the test. And so you investigate it as deeply as you possibly can. And after you've done that and you can't go any further, then you go back to the breathing meditation, back to the walking meditation, back to your mantra. Any type of mantra, could be the changeability mantra, could be loving kindness, whatever you like to do. And then you do your meditation for at least another 5 minutes, get some samadhi power. Then you go into that experience again, and you contemplate it, and you understand everything about it completely in its entirety. And after you've exhausted the investigation, you go back to the samadhi meditation, the peaceful meditation. You do that for at least 5 minutes, then you go back to the difficulty, this obstruction of the mind. And so every 5 minutes, back and forth. And, you know, some people might find this quite disturbing. Like they may think, oh, look, you know, I don't want to have to keep thinking about this thing. But the bottom line is that you're stuck with this thing is because you haven't gone into it, you haven't understood it, and it's not released. So if you really want to fast track this kind of stuff when problems come up, 5 minutes on the peaceful meditation, samadhi meditation, 5 minutes on vipassana, investigation, understanding this thing, this experience in its entirety. And you watch the mind very carefully as you're going back and forth, and you'll see the mind release its grip, at least to a small degree, because the mind in itself, you know, you have the pure mind, and then you have the defilements which are impregnated, which are are absorbed into, which colour the mind, the defilements, the all these different unpleasant moods and feelings and all these things that you know of, which that the Buddha told us to release and let go, to purify, you know, all these things which are entangled with the mind. So you've got the mind, you've got the defilements which permeate the mind, and then you've got the sense faculties. So you've got all that together: sense faculties, the mind, defilements. This is our personal experience. So, and then you watch the mind, you watch your mind experience, your personal experience, and you watch the way the mind responds, you know, going back and forth. And you will see it. You do this several times. You will see the mind slowly, you know, release its grip. It will release its grip because the mind has understood something, at least to a small degree. The mind in itself, that deep mind, that pure mind, you know, has wisdom according to Dhamma, has intuitive intelligence according to Dhamma. But from the beginning to the intermediate stages, you have to keep teaching yourself again and again and again and again, because the mind experience for the vast majority of the population, 99.9% of the population, you have to teach yourself, because the mind, you have to teach yourself in the sense that the mind, it does not know and understand. All the pure mind only knows awareness. There's only this pure awareness which knows objects, knows feelings. It's this knowing, this deep, profound knowing. But that's the only function that the mind has, the pure mind at the deepest level. It's not born with wisdom or understanding or intuitive intelligence. It's something that you have to develop. So this is why we got we put this emphasis on wisdom. So it doesn't matter what you're doing with your practice. You could be doing all sorts of wild and amazing things with the meditation. Yeah, there's 1,001 ways you can meditate, but the bottom line is that the wisdom faculty has got to be there, you know, watching over, understanding, investigating, and you know, at suitable times, you know. You know, you choose when you want to contemplate, you know, when not to. I can give people a broad range of instructions, but the bottom line is that you have to tailor make, you know, you have to tailor make your Dhamma experience for good results. And you know, I've experimented with 101 things over the years. And the meditation's just going very well with this Anicca Sanya. I'm doing this with the heavy stuff. I'm doing it on bodily organs, liver, lungs, brain. And you think to yourself that it would really, you know, you'd really get disgusted, or really, you know, this would be very, very unpleasant. But this meditation is working very well, and it's actually bringing me a lot of happiness to a reasonable degree, joy, positivity. You know, you wouldn't think so, but it is, because the samadhi, it's getting some depth to it. So you know, you've got to be careful with this kind of stuff when you go to the body, but you know, this is the best results I've seen in a long time. But with the mainstream practitioners, you've got to be careful with this kind of stuff. It's mainly for the monastics, but with the mainstream meditators, Dhamma practitioners, you focus on the soft and fluffy and comfortable things, you know, the things that you like. It can be biology, chemistry, nuclear physics, things in nature, all the sciences, you know. It could be things like, it could be anything, absolutely anything. flowers, plants, you know, anything you can possibly think of which resonates with you, which is important to you. And then you use that changeability principle. So, you know, if you really want to see the meditation bite and get some depth to it, that's the way I would approach the summative meditation. And then I would move back and forth every 5 minutes, samatha, vipassana, to really get some depth and make sure that the wisdom faculty is there and it's firm and it's watching over everything. So nothing escapes you. There's nothing hidden from you. This is the reason why we get stuck with problems for 20, 30 years, because there's something that you still have not seen and understood. And this is all of us. This is the monks and nuns and the lay practitioners. It's the same for all of us. You know, the mind. You know, the mind has got characteristics from the beginners, intermediate, and the most profound level. But the way that we approach. You know, there's a number of very solid principles. What would you call it? Different things and different, like techniques that we can use to get good results over 10, 20, 30 years. Did that make sense to you guys?
No, that makes sense. That really does make sense, Ajahn. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no worries at all, Chris.
Marley, we have a question here about how to cope with negative people.
Sorry, how to do what?
I'm sorry, how to cope with negative people.
Negative people?
Negative in our environment. To give you an idea,
I mean, especially in the monastery, and that, you know, I'm quite, you know, I don't, I tend to be like reasonably open. With the monks' experience and whatnot, but in our monastery, if you've got someone who's really negative, pessimistic, irritable, even potentially angry, what the monks tend to do is you just avoid them. You don't speak to them, you don't contact them. It might be difficult if they're sometimes partners can be a little bit tricky, or even like say family members, maybe even mum and dad, where, you know, you can't avoid that person. So what you do, so even if you're in the same house with them, you minimize. I mean, it's difficult with boyfriends, girlfriends, husbands, wives. What I would tend to do, like, I'm, you know, naturally I'm not an expert on this kind of stuff, being a celibate monk for 26 odd years, but what I would In a general sense, with the general population, you minimize the contact, because as soon as you come into contact with that person and the trouble flares up or trouble comes up, the most obvious thing is just keep away from them. Don't speak to them, don't phone them, don't email them unless you have to. And it might sound, a little bit... what's the right word? A little bit dismissive and maybe a little bit non-confronting. But that's exactly what our monks do. If we don't like someone, or we got someone who's a hard case or likes to fight or wants to make trouble, you know, you just don't speak to them, and you don't speak to them for weeks or months on end. And the monks are pretty tough. We can do that easily. If somebody really tries to make trouble with me, I won't talk to you for 6 months, and I won't even sweat, you know. So the monks, that's what we do. You know, that's an approach, but I'm not seeing this is only one approach among many. So with partners, you know, being a bit more positive about this with partners, you can use Buddhist principles. But I would definitely get the rock-solid experience that you get with a senior marriage guidance counsellor, especially women. Women tend to do quite well with the senior ladies who are professional counsellors, relationship counsellors. They're worth their weight in gold. So I would definitely recommend people in this category. But So what, you know, say if, say for example, if I put myself in your shoes, I was in society, I was in, say, my workplace, I had a difficult person to deal with. What I would tend to do is because sometimes you've got no idea exactly where people are at, what's actually happening to them, what they're going through. And some people may even though they look angry and they're irritable, and you know, you don't necessarily enjoy talking to them, being in company, you may have to make an effort and just talk to them and find out what's going on, because we can't read people's minds. We really don't know what they're going through. I mean, to give you an idea, one of our guys, our lay disciples connected with the monastery, is a very, very bright young man, and he's been working for quite some time now. He told me that his boss was just a very unpleasant piece of work. You know, the guy is irritable and he raises his voice, and you know, he's dissatisfied with other people in the company, and this guy is going through a very nasty divorce with this partner, and he's basically taking it out, and he's projecting. You know, he can't, I mean, I don't know the exact dynamics. He may be, I mean, they probably can't stand each other to the point where they may have actually parted company. But, you know, he's still being affected by this to a significant degree. And he's projecting this stuff on the people at work. And our young man is, you know, a meditator and a long-term practitioner. But what he did was he left the company. This went on for so long, he wasn't prepared to put up with this, and he left, and he got a job with a company where the people got on and they were happy to be there. There were good interpersonal dynamics, not perfect, but more than satisfactory, and he was so much happier within himself, because he's a meditator. You know, he's a big, solid, you know, he's a young, solid, strong young guy who can look after himself, but he's a sensitive person, and you know, he doesn't want to put up with this nonsense with this boss who's, you know, constantly, he's angry, irritable, who's, you know, you just don't want to spend time with him. So the easy way and the smart way was just leave the company and get a new job where the circumstances were so much better. So what else? I mean, what else would I do if I was in mainstream society? Yeah, that principle, getting back to that, because it can be quite crucial that you use the Buddha's reference with this. You choose the time and the place. You make sure you catch them at the right time. You make sure you catch them when they're in a good mood. They're not angry. They're not upset. They're not being compromised by any means, and then you ask them, you know, is it okay if I talk to you privately for a couple of minutes, and then take them aside, take them in a separate room. Do not do this in front of other people whatsoever, because some people can get quite toey and get defensive. And take them into another room where you won't be disturbed, and no one will hear. You know, no one will know about this, the conversation. And then you say what you do. You do the compassionate approach. You say, look, Bill. I've noticed that, you know, it looks like you might be having be non-confrontational. You know, emotional intelligence. I've noticed that, you know, it looks like you're going through a bit of a hard time, I don't know like exactly. You can tell him straight up, or her, you know, I really don't understand what you're going through. Is it possible that you can basically just tell me what's going on, what you're going through, if I can help you or support you? You will find that the majority of people, when you approach them like this, when you give them an opportunity to open up and share non-confrontational, non-attack, compassionate, you know, I'm here, I'm prepared to listen to what you've got to say, and get them to, you know, that with that emotional intelligence, non-confrontational approach, get them to talk to you and tell you, you know, exactly what's happening. Because I don't, you know, like I don't understand what's going on, why you're, you know, with your mood, you know, this and that. You know, I want you to tell, you know, in a gentle way, I want you to tell me what's going on. And you will find more than 50%, at least 75% will appreciate the fact that you've taken the time to give them an opportunity to let you know what's going on. Because they're dealing with this problem, this difficulty. And some of their workers, their subordinates, I mean, they just they're going to minimize the contact. They can see you in a bad mood, and they will avoid you if they can, and they'll minimize the contact. But you've got to get that person to tell you exactly what's happening. And it can certainly diffuse, what they're going through, because you know you've demonstrated very clearly that you've taken the time to show some compassion, intelligent, it's like emotional, like listening. You're listening and trying to understand exactly what's happening. You know, get them to talk to you.
Empathy.
Yeah, empathy. Exactly. Empathy. And you'll find if once they talk to you, they get it off their chest. Somebody's actually taken the time to ask them, what's wrong? You know, I'm concerned about you. I care enough to ask you what's happening. You can ventilate, you can share, even if the person gets a bit angry, because they could still be projecting. You just be patient and you listen, because if you don't get them to open up and talk, this thing will fester inside them for easily. It could go on for 3, 6, 9 months because it's inside them. And it's not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere, I mean, very fast at all. Some people, no matter how smart some people are, their emotional understanding, the intelligence is not at the same level. And some people, no matter how smart they are, if they don't see a counsellor, a really good quality counsellor, they may not be able to fix their stuff very easily at all. So if they're not seeing anyone, they're not talking to anyone, that person could be stuck with that thing, that experience for months or even a year or two, depending what's going on. And if I try to think of something else, another principle is, if you've got someone who's really heavy, really, really difficult, constantly, like a monkey on your back, you can do things like, you can do this kind of death principle where you imagine that this person is going to die, and it sounds odd, but it's an attitude where, say for example, Bill or Fred is very 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 difficult at work, or very very difficult in the family, and what you do, you do this thing, you do it like once every minute or once every couple of minutes. Even when they're not around, or even when you're in contact with them in the family, you do things like, say, like Bill will die or Fred will die. Just a little mantra like that. And when you start to get this thing rolling, you get this attitude that this person is not going to live very long. That their life on this earth is finite, and they're not going to be with us for they'll only be with us for a short period of time, not very long. And after a while, you start to feel sorry for them. Their lifespan is limited. They're going to go, and they're going to leave us. So you start to feel sorry. So even if they start jumping up and down, and they could be an incredibly difficult person. But when you develop this attitude that then they're not going to be long. They're not going to be around very long, and you're going to part company. you really start to develop some compassion. You feel sorry for them. They're suffering. You know, they're suffering. They're in pain. And they could die with that pain. That emotional difficulty, the discomfort, the suffering. It could go. You know, if they don't do something about it, it could go on for 5, 10, 15 years. You know, with some people. And that little death mantra can really undermine the aversion that you have towards that person. So let me.
That does actually sound like an interesting technique, Ajahn. And Gloria has a question for you. What if she's going back to the original topic of anxiety? What if part of the emotion is not something that you can be conscious of, or is something that you have forgotten?
So for example, I've got anxiety, but it's very, very deep. It could be something in childhood, or maybe when I was a very, very young person. I could have blocked it out. I can't remember. I just can't connect it with myself, a person, this and that. What I would tend to do is the feely-feely meditation. So in order to deal with anxiety that I just can't really understand or identify, I can't reach it, I would do the feely-feely meditation. And in order to get in contact with these feelings, I would watch all the feelings, doing the breath meditation, and then focusing on all the feelings in the chest. So this is a very fast way to get, a quicker way to get in contact with deeper, deeper emotions. So as I'm breathing in and out, I'm focusing all the feelings in the upper, middle, chest and the abdomen. So from here, from the throat right to the lower abdomen, to the tummy, I'm focusing on all these feelings as I'm breathing in and out. And that will, and if you really want to fast track this kind of experience, you're focusing on that full chest area, full chest, and then do that for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and then see if you can feel that anxiety, see if you can actually feel it. Because when you do stuff like that, it's going to come up, because you know you're focusing on this area. You're focusing on the feeling-based area. So don't be surprised, even after 5-10 minutes, you'll start to feel the anxiety. It'll be there. It'll be air in that area. It could be in the middle of the chest. It could be in the tummy. It could be on the left side of my chest, for some reason. It could even be an injury. It could be an anxiety related to some injury on the left side of my chest. So once it may start to manifest, it makes itself known, and then you focus on the anxiety, and you use that as your meditation object. So focus on the anxiety for nothing less than, say, several minutes, and then start to question it. This feeling of anxiety, where is it located? It's located on, it could be in my upper chest. Could be in my heart area, and you know what is this feeling made of? What this tangibility? How does it affect me? What's it made of? And then explore the feeling, and go deeper, deeper, deeper into the feeling, and try to keep understanding the quality of it, all about the nature of this of the anxiety, this feeling and the. In the chest or in the abdomen. And then after you've exhausted the investigation, because I'm focusing on exactly where the problem is. If I have anxiety in the middle of my chest, I have some childhood trauma, some stuff when I was a young person, and I can feel it. There's something deeper down, and it's come up. Focus right there, and then just gently for several minutes or so. And then start to question it to the best of your ability. And after you've exhausted the investigation, the understanding of this thing, then go back to watching. What and you've got to keep focused, very relaxed, keep focused on the anxiety, because this is where we're stuck. You know, this is where, say, the problem is, our area of concern, and keep focusing there for at least several minutes, and then go back to reflection again. Keep exploring, understanding this experience, and then after you've exhausted the investigation, go back to watching, and reflection. So go back and forth roughly every several minutes, and you'll find, when you use that kind of focus, because it's a little bit, it's a little bit, what would you call it? It's quite firm, it's quite firm. It's very, very precise, because you're focusing on exactly where the problem lies. But if you want to shift these problems and difficulties in the shortest possible time, this is something which can fast track this kind of experience. And, because some people can see counselors for like 10, 20 years, but when you go to your physical body, you get your physical body to tell you where the problem is, and why, location. Use the body as a tool, as a bridge to the emotions, and then question the emotions. And let me think. That book, for Gloria, there's a book which is put out by, Eugene. It's a book by Eugene D. Jellin, and she's an expert with this particular technique, and it's called Focusing. And this book, Focusing, on the front cover, it's been out for a number of years. It's an electronic version as well. And on the front cover, it's pebbles. You've got pebbles under water, under a flowing body of water. And this lady is, I'm pretty sure, I get the feeling that she's a Buddhist. She's a Vipassana-based person and a meditator, and she's an expert with this technique. And for whatever, $15, $16, it's well worth downloading her book and reading. I mean, you can master this technique in 7 days flat, But if you want to actually read, if you want to like read about a person who's an expert with this technique, and it's got like proven, documented cases, it's well worth actually having a look at her latest edition.